I'm Dan Erlander. I'm the staff here at Holden Village, and we're gathered here for the first of two parts. The second part will be tomorrow night at the same time. And I hope you'll be able to come to both, because tonight will be the more depressing session, and tomorrow night the more hopeful. So if you're leaving the village tomorrow, be sure to talk to me or something about this. The title is Fear and Faith in the Nuclear Age, and I'd like to share something about how I got involved in this subject of war and peace, the nuclear arms race, especially in relation to Lutheran theology. I should say at the beginning that it's unusual, or it's somewhat different for me to be involved in a subject like this that I suppose is controversial. When I got involved in it, my mother called when I was out, and she said, "You know, you're into something controversial." And true. And with seriousness, I would say it's much more comfortable. I go out sometimes and lead retreats on third century baptism, and I find that much more comfortable. One, nobody knows anything about it, so nobody can question. But also this fear of war and peace, it's a highly emotional issue. We each have a lot of our emotions tied up in this issue, and maybe one of the deepest human drives and feelings is for security for ourselves and for our loved ones. And therefore, when we talk about this, some people feel the arms race is causing insecurity, and others very deeply feel that to talk about peacemaking is to let down the defenses of our country and make us insecure. So underneath it all, there's a lot of feelings, and I'm sensitive to these as we go along. The way I got involved in this is really part from coming from a close family ties with my older brother, who's also a pastor. And I served in Albuquerque, New Mexico before coming to Holden, and he was in Colorado Springs, so we were getting together all of the time. And when I was coming here, we were sad because we wouldn't get together very often. Then he thought of this idea. He says, "I'm in charge of getting a speaker for a workshop on the arms race, and you'll be the speaker." And I said no, because I was interested in it and concerned, but hadn't studied it. So I said no, but my older brother has a quality called stubbornness. Wouldn't let me say no, so I finally said yes. I came up here to Holden then a year ago, January, and then had like 2 months to kind of pull something together to present at this workshop. And really that was the beginning of an involvement that I've had ever since. Although any of you who study this topic know you have to take breaks. I have to go weeks without even reading about it before I plunge back in. So that's how I got involved. I also have one peace joke at the beginning. I think this is cute. The prophet was really proud because his message was finally getting across, and he really felt smug because the people were finally listening to him. And then the disciples of the prophet came into him and said, "Now what do we do? They're hitting each other with their plowshares." Another one I like is to show that I never have been involved in a lot of really radical stuff, that I kiddingly say that during the Vietnam War I was among the kind of minor rebels. I boiled my draft card. So that's a joke. I really didn't. So. Yeah, I'd like to plunge into this topic by looking at the chart behind me. Can you all see this chart on the board? And some of you maybe have seen this, but it was done by some people in Vermont, and then the senatorial staff of the senator from Vermont checked this out to check its accuracy. and found it to be accurate. But I'll explain it to you now. If you look at the dot in the center, can you see the dot in the very center of the chart? That dot stands for all the explosive power of all the weapons detonated during World War II. 3 million tons of TNT, or we'd say 3 megatons. That's the one dot. Okay, then each of the dots in the entire chart is one World War II. That is all of the firepower of World War II, including Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Each of those dots represents also 3 megatons. Then all of the dots together represent the firepower of all of the nuclear weapons that are in existence in the world today. 18,000 megatons, or 6,000 World War IIs. Now, the little circle up here surrounds the firepower of one Poseidon submarine. And then the little larger circle down there, the firepower of one Trident submarine. And then the larger circle here, it should surround 100 dots, or 100 World War IIs. And that represents the firepower that would be needed to destroy every major and medium-sized city in the entire world. Would be 100 dots, or approximately within that circle. I never get accustomed to this chart. You know, it always comes to me. Every time I look at it, it comes as a shock again. And the only response I have is to gasp. In relation to it, to think of some things like Robert McNamara said in 69, we need 200 to 400 warheads to deter the Soviet Union. And now we can deliver 10,000. And I understand the goal of the administration is 20,000. But then I think of what this chart doesn't show. The increased east-west tension, more nations with nuclear capacity, possibility of terrorist groups. And then also what the chart doesn't show is the increased sophistication of the weapons, the delivery systems, the accuracy, the delivery time becoming less and less and less. And then I think there's other ways to also look at this chart. One is to just really allow myself to feel. And sometimes this is the hardest thing to do, is to look at this chart and then to see loved ones. See them frying in nuclear heat and running from firestorms. See the people that are closest to me crying for water or wasting away with cancerous bodies. Or to look at the chart and see the end of the human race. When I look at this chart, you know, I really can't talk about it in words. I have to use pictures. Or images. One of the images would be a kid in my college dorm when I was a freshman at PLU, and this kid was big. And also he would often go out and get drunk. When he'd come back to the dorm, it would take 6 or 7 of us to really hold him down. His body would just have gone so berserk. Or I think of Catherine, a dear person in Albuquerque that I ministered to and shared life with during the last weeks and months of her life. Her cancer spread so quickly that tumors were just literally bulging out of her eye sockets. And I have to close my eyes and see that picture of her body, or this friend, to start to begin to grasp that something, and this chart brings it home to me so in a powerful way, something in our world is so out of control. Out of control. Now, the most common response, and a couple months ago I was speaking about this in Nebraska and also visiting my relatives, and I talked to almost every one of them about it in Nebraska and found this almost 100% is numbness. In other words, when you look at this, the problem is so overwhelming that our kind of response is just to be numb about it, and that means pretending like it doesn't exist and kind of going through the motions of a normal daily life, and pretend almost that we live in normal times and go about our activities. And I just, do you know what I mean? Is that a normal, kind of a normal response? And I just read a paper this week, one of the staff people who wrote about the situation of children in the bomb and how frightened children are and how that fright is increased by the fact that adults are afraid to talk about it. Now, by the way, what I have here is a session I presented in Nebraska, and it took a half hour. So I hope I can do that here, and then we'll have some time to talk about where we are. That means I have to keep moving. So, when my wife is here, she's out of the village now, but she sits in the back and goes like this, and it starts slowing down. I want to announce now a wonderful thing, I think, about being a Christian. And I think, especially our Lutheran tradition that I share, really brings that out, and that is this: we don't have to be afraid of the dark. We don't have to be afraid of the dark, because central to our teaching is what we call the theology of the cross. And the theology of the cross basically is this: that it is in the darkest and the most despairing and the most painful part of human existence that God chooses to meet us in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And it's a way of saying there's no despair or darkness where I can go in the entire universe where God is not. And even the theology of the cross would say that it is especially there that we meet Christ on the cross. Also, if we believe in grace, I can go into the darkness and know that my security rests in the forgiveness in Jesus Christ, and not going having to say that my country has no faults or no mistakes, or that we're not involved in sinfulness. I can go into the darkness of both my own sinfulness and the sinfulness of my country and my world in security, because grace teaches me that my status and my identity as a person is never threatened by the darkness around me. So with that theology of the cross as a background, we move now into this evil. And I think it's so important to say this at the beginning. When I was back in Nebraska, a pastor that's an old friend of my family, in fact, to him I'm Danny, you know, because he remembers me as a kid, you know, and he brought me into his home. And he said, you know, this is really a complicated thing, you know, to get involved in the military system and going around as a preacher and speaking about it. I know he was very worried about me because I'd get tripped up on megatons and things. And my response, and I think it's really from the bottom of my heart, that I guess I'm basically a preacher. And the preaching of the gospel always has to be in the context of liberation, and to talk about liberation, we talk about liberation from. And so I told him, they announce wherever I go that I'm to speak on the arms race, but I'm just really going around preaching the gospel, kind of a traveling evangelist, I guess. And I hope you'll feel that my concern about this isn't finally that I have a good political solution, but a concern that we move into this issue and there find the gospel of Jesus Christ. So with that, now we'll go in. A place I find to start is with something that is very orthodox, I suppose, and very Lutheran. That is to start with the concept of the orders of creation. And we say, and I think rightly so, we say the orders of creation or the systems of creation are basically good. I'll save this. orders of creation are like government. They're like economic systems, government systems, educational systems, culture, recreational systems, all of these different orders that kind of hold human life together. And we say they are created by God and they are gifts of God for human good. I mean, and we know this. What if we had no economic system? You know, what would you do if you woke up in the morning and there's no Safeway to go to? You know, and of course, Safeway is not a redeemed corporation that is the kingdom of God. At least I don't think it is. And yet we say it's a gift of God, an economic system, because it kind of holds human life together and makes human functioning possible. Probably the profoundest order of creation that affects our lives is family. Family is a creation of God. And we say, along with all of creation, we say that the orders of creation are good. As I was created good, but I fall. And I think the briefest way to say what my fall is, a little something that happened to me when I lived in San Diego. I was walking down the street, saw a man walking towards me down the street, and immediately I said, "We're different." Because he had greasy hair going back and a t-shirt, and it was rolled up in his cigarettes, and you know how you stick them in the... And as we got closer and passed each other, I kind of looked at him out of the corner of my eye, and he had a tattoo on his arm, and it said, "Born to Love." And I'm bashful, so I don't go up to people and say, "Wow," and all that. But I wanted to. I just wanted to say, that's it. You know, born to love. It's probably not what he meant by this thing on his arm. But... but isn't that why I was created? To be a lover of God and God's creation and my human brothers and sisters. And my fall is when I turn from that and go another way. And we say, just as I fall, so do the orders of creation. And simply means they too turn from their God-given intention, and the intention of God is that they serve humanity. And when the orders fall, they turn, and then they demand that humans serve them. Now, Jesus was aware of this. Remember, he said, the Sabbath was made for humans and not humans for the Sabbath. You know, the Sabbath being part of the religious order for humans, not humans for the Sabbath. So we recognize that the orders of creation fall and they turn. But as Lutherans, and this is part of what we call Lutheran orthodoxy, even if you want to say it, that we say that even a fallen order still functions for the good of humanity. Or it's a very Lutheran way of saying no matter how bad government is, it's probably better than no government. That fallen institutions still serve to kind of hold human life together and even to keep us from all just killing each other. You know, even the Soviet government system at least keeps all the citizens from killing each other. So it's very kind of a negative thing that's what Lutheran teaching says. However, now there is a danger in a system that has turned and has fallen, and that is that system may just go completely out of control, or we could even use the word berserk, or the word demonic. And I think the way to understand that is to look at past systems that have obviously gone completely out of control. You know, maybe the most obvious is the Nazi system. Here is government created by God for the good of human beings, but turns and goes out of control and then demands absolute servitude of human beings and finally leads them to destruction. You know, others would be the 18th, 19th century economic system of slavery. Maybe you could look at Jim Jones' People's Temple. And I think when you look at these kind of obvious examples, there's really three characteristics that start becoming clear, at least to me. One, the system becomes a god, meaning it demands absolute obedience from the subjects. Then that system promises well-being to the subjects, some form of a salvation system. Then the subjects, believing the promise of that salvation, give their obedience. And by obedience, I mean worship or total obedience. And then the third characteristic is that that system can never finally deliver on the promise of salvation, fails, and the people who worship that system are finally devastated. Now, the conclusion then I reach is that when those characteristics are present in a system, then at least for me, I say that system has become demonic. Now, what I did in my journey then is to say, I'll examine now the military system of this world and also of my nation and ask, has it become in a way demonic? And I want to make a very important point here that we're talking about the system and not about the people involved in the system. You know, and I can't make that clear enough. You know, we're not accusing someone who's in the military or someone who is in the manufacture of nuclear weapons. We're talking about examining a system and asking, has it gone out of control? And as Lutherans, I think especially, we have a background for this. Our church really started by a monk who examined the system he was involved in and made a decision that it had gone out of control. And so it's from that, and it's important to say as Lutherans, we're talking about government and even the military part of government, which traditionally Lutherans would say is a legitimate government service for the protection of the citizens. Okay, we'll begin now, and then I went from there to now examine militarism and or the military system in this world. And this next part, if I don't just read it, I get carried away. So I'm just going to read it to you. Okay, first question, what promise does the system make? Does it make a promise? And I think it does make a promise, and that is security. Meaning much more than safety, but also that security of the confidence that we are the number one in the world. So I think the system does promise a form of secular salvation in the form of security in really two layers. Then the question, believing that promise, do we as a people make a sacrifice or make almost a total sacrifice? And the response is the world certainly makes a sacrifice. $600 billion a year are spent by the world on military preparation. And remember, that's when 500 million people are hungry. Hitler lost the Second World War, but in a way, Hitler won. Because his belief that brute power is the way to live politically in the world has almost been enthusiastically adopted by almost every nation on earth. Then I'd ask it about my nation. Do we in the United States worship this system? And when I look at the sacrifice for myself, I say yes. And here's just some things I wrote down. In the next 5 years, we will give about $1.6 trillion to the system. And when I say this figure, remember it means everything from weapons and new weapons all the way down to veterans hospitals. Okay, so I need to be fair about that. $1.6 trillion to the system. Now, this amounts, and this is from Time Magazine, to $20,000 per household. In other words, in the next 5 years, the average tax-paying household in the United States will give $20,000. And money is the fruit of our toil. And you just think of the hours and hours and hours of toil each one of us puts into the system. what do we sacrifice or whom do we sacrifice? And I'm moving now into really asking, is the system an idol? You know, and you have to look and you read about our bridges, roads, dams, water systems, sewer systems crumble, our schools go begging. Many economists say the arms race is crippling our economy and the world economy. The poor suffer the most as funding is cut for food assistance, child nutrition, energy cost assistance, housing, education, legal services, medical aid, job training, handicapped assistance. Not to cut the budget, but to feed the insatiable appetite of what I call a hungry God. And human beings are sacrificed. Severed, I could show you the book, but tells of the incredible work we could do in the world for $50 billion. I remember this is 3% of our military budget over the next 5 years. 3%. And she shows or illustrates the vast projects throughout the world. And remember, this doesn't mean money solves anything, everything. Vocational training, direct food aid, assistance to small farmers, primary school building, teacher training, nuclear waste disposal, tree planting, clean air, vaccine protection to all the world's children, family planning, maternal health, job training. She shows, illustrates, and this is, we're talking about 3%. Think of the many humans who die every day because of what Eisenhower called the theft from those who are hungry and not fed, cold and not clothed. Okay, then I move from there to say, is our sacrifice even greater than this? More than money, the environment? We also, I think, sacrifice what we can never put on a chart or never put in statistics, and that is our very souls. The question is, do we die spiritually as we affirm by our offering to the system that violence is the way to solve problems? And I just feel it, that what does this do to us, to our children, to our nation? How does this encourage violent crime, family violence? What does the insecurity of an uncertain future do to children? How does it contribute to drug abuse, to alcoholism, to juvenile delinquency? Now, when we hear the talk of a protective ABM system, billions and billions and billions of dollars more, then we ask, what are we finally protecting? Is it a nation rotting? A nation that has lost its soul? A nation hiding from the violence even of its neighbors? A nation spiritually dead? And now I'm going to stop reading. And I just share this. How the more I've looked into this situation that I see just out of control, there's a sense how I weep for this nation. And I think for me it comes out of a love for my nation. That we give all of this, even of our souls, and why. I wonder if it is this, that we believe a promise. And then is that promise a lie? Because as each $1 billion is spent, true security seems further and further away. And as each new system seems to be developed, it seems to me that our security is less and less and less. One example, the new systems that will be installed in Europe by this December. Part of our reason for building them is we want them to drive the Soviets to the bargaining table. But then our honor is at stake, and we have to install them, and then we're narrowing the time down to 6 to 8 minutes that the Soviets have to respond, and it's a way that we put our security in Soviet computers. that have to decide on whether or not there's a mistake or there's an attack. And when it comes, and I pray, and I know you do, that it never will, who will be defended or who will be safe? And I think that it'll be a few people in deep cavern control centers, a few in very high altitude airplanes or distant submarines. And who will burn in the nuclear oven? But we who willingly believed a lie, who willingly paid for it, trusted a system that had gone berserk, and then, as all systems that have become demonic, the system fails. But why does the system go on and on? And we could cite many reasons: our fear of the Soviet Union, the military, industrial, technical, university, political complex that you hear about, which reaps benefits. But I think beneath all the reasons, what keeps the system going, it's a confession of faith that we believe in violence. And we put our trust in violence. And this is our darkness. This is our despair. And it's a darkness where Christ would meet us. Now, just one thought on despair. I think despair is exactly the condition of the disciples between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. When Jesus died on the cross, they thought all was lost. And part of that meant that the way of Jesus, which meant there's another way to live in this world, and by violence, by brute force. But the crucifixion came as not only had humans totally discredited Jesus, but also God had discredited Jesus. And so it was despair. Meaning, I guess, the cycle of violence goes on, and it's the only reality there is in the world. And they or we have only two ways, I think, to act on that despair or to respond to that despair. One way is just to give up. Just to give up. And the other way is to just accept things as they are and become involved in the system and believe in the system. But for a Christian to be in that kind of despair is to put ourselves exactly in the place where the disciples were before Easter. And here is the good news: that we live with Easter. And I remember one Easter Sunday when I was a teenager when I decided I didn't believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus. Any of you ever have one of those years? And I remember singing in the youth choir, and our song was, "My Heart is Glad." You know, and I sang those, but my heart was miserable. You know, I just didn't believe this. As an adult now, I see the way that now I wouldn't believe in Easter is somehow to believe that violence and brute force is the way to live in the world. Because I believe Easter was God's vindication of Jesus in another way, and it's in that way is our hope. And so that's where I'm going to end, and then tomorrow look at what we mean by that hope that is in Christ. So I'd like to stop there now and just now invite you to come with responses that are feeling or questions that are intellectual, and two things I want to say before we talk. Sometimes when I present this, I get so fervent, I'm afraid it's going to threaten anybody out that disagrees with me, and I don't want that to happen. I want us to be able to discuss. And the other point, I forgot. The need, I think, for the church to always talk about this issue theologically and from the standpoint of faith. So with that, just not sure, want to welcome any of your feelings or responses. Yeah, go ahead.
Given all that, what is our objective as a Christian? Is it the elimination, from your viewpoint, the elimination of all nuclear weapons, freeze, and reduction? And my response, my question is based on the fact that all we need is that red circle to destroy everything. Then whether we have 10,000 or 20,000 really is irrelevant. All we need is 100, and everything else is just meaningless. From a military point of view.
Yeah. If I could comment on that briefly, you know, and then that's part of what I'm going to present tomorrow night. Will you be here?
I'm afraid of that.
You're afraid he was going to say, "No, I'll get 24 hours to figure that out." where we'll move tomorrow is the. And again, we have to start, I think, with the concept of the body of Christ. You know, that I think Christ needs in this world people that make the radical and the risking proclamation that I will live without arms. Now, the thing is that some people are so threatened by that because they're afraid that that means that that person is advocating that for the policy of the United States. And, you know, one thing, it's obvious that this is not going to be adopted. I think I would have general agreement on that. I think in the body of Christ there also needs to be people that will use the very best rational, reasonable sense in this world to meet with other rational, reasonable people. To figure out the very best security position that a nation like ours can have. And I want to expand on that a little tomorrow. You know, and I'll make the point now is I think our problem is that we have become so totally uncreative as a nation that we forget that there are ways for security other than military might. You know that in your neighborhood, that getting along with your neighbor is probably a better form of security than all the fences and guns that you can gather, right? You know, but we'll work on that some more tomorrow, of how the body of Christ can function in the real world. The point I want to get across, so you'll know when you come tomorrow what I want to get across, is that the church needs its people that take the most risking position to. We'll look at that. Anybody else?
Wasn't one of Christ's parables something, I don't remember it very well, Dan, but it just came to mind now. And wasn't one of his parables about a man who did not prepare adequately to protect his house? People came in and
a thief came in.
Yeah, what do you do when this is presented as the absolute truth that this could Christ then expected you to protect yourself?
Okay, that parable Jesus uses an example of preparing for the second coming. Mm-hmm. You know, it has really. And I think it's a very important point right at the beginning. I think I want to hold that for tomorrow.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. Holly.
Well, in response to the question here about what would a Christian position be, I'm sorry, I can't help but I talk about hope when you talk about despair. But it seems to me that something a Christian could do, any Christian could do, would just be to say, let's take one step backwards and see what the Russians do. And that, the fact that our nation is not willing to do that in any way, shape, or form at all, shows me how demonically possessed the nation is by the belief in violence and fear as the only way of life. One small step, we can't even take one step and say, we'll destroy this, will you destroy? And I think if any Christian can just do that mentally, they will have really made a huge step to just say, let's try it. Let's try reconciliation.
I feel sorry.
Don't try it with my life. Sorry, I don't want to. I don't want to wait.
Swallow us alive if we did this.
Hmm?
The Russians would swallow us alive if we backed up.
I could. I feel very sorry for both nations in a way, because I think both nations came out of the Second World War extremely frightened. You know, we had been devastated by Pearl Harbor. You know, we really came out of the war never again, and the Soviet Union came out of the war with 20 million dead. And so, I heard the words of extreme fright of the Soviet Union, and one thing I've learned in my studies is what's called parallel fear. You know, that the very thing I heard expressed there is exactly what Soviet people fear of the United States. They have the same fear, and they know that we used nuclear weapons, and also there was a time in the early 20th century when American soldiers were on Soviet soil. But I've really tried to hear that, every fear that we have of the Soviet Union, they have of us. So is the answer then to just each one of us build more and more and more and more arms? Then we have to start asking, are we possessed by demons? To ask the really religious or theological question, are we possessed by demons, or did Satan, and I'm getting more and more comfortable using the word Satan. You know, I used to be such a sophisticated young pastor that didn't use any non-intellectual words. But do the powers of evil, have the powers of evil taken the fear of both the United States and the Soviet Union and turned it into something that would bring the destruction of the human race? Okay, I'm talking.
Dan?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that Holly back here?
Uh-huh.
I think either of you, or both of you, that the little girl riding to Russia and being there, we saw that picture in the paper a couple of days ago, is that one small step?
I haven't read that. So
she
I don't
wrote,
so.
Our little children don't want to die, and I'm sure your little children don't want to die. And Andrew Pope invited her over to Russia, and she's there right now.
What about this fear, you know, that this fear that our questioning in our military power is an invitation to be invaded? Or, it's a very real fear, isn't it? Yeah, go ahead.
When I hear nuclear arms race, I always hear the Soviet Union and the United States. Did our real threat come from the Soviet Union, or how many other nations in the world could destroy us that, you know, we really don't fear? I mean, is it a buildup of the United States against the Soviet Union? What other countries that are not even in the race, or whatever this craziness is called, had that same
thing? Yeah, it's nation, well, Britain, France, China, India.
And stuff they can't find all over the place, and people that can make nuclear bombs, you know?
The possibility of South Africa and Israel, both very frightened nations. So we're, you know, it's the trick that I've tried to say is the very system that we've trusted for security somehow has turned around against us. Then what do we do?
Also, the five major nuclear powers, four are aimed at Russia. Their weapons are aimed at Russia.
Yeah, including mainland China.
Mm-hmm. If if we had in complete, there were such a thing, complete political control of our country, a committed Christian who then turned to you and asked, what would you suggest I do with my political power and my faith in terms of the bomb? What might you suggest to him?
Anybody want to answer? I mean, like, you're the President of the United States.
And not a weak one, but with very, very full political power. You got the nation with you to do what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And you really want to do the right thing. And you're his advisor. What might you recommend to him to be the right thing?
Is this to respond to this?
I was going to suggest that if he really had that kind of power and could sway the Congress and so on and so on, that we wage peace as strongly as we're waging war.
Okay.
That we really become aggressive about peace initiatives in terms of meeting people's needs, hunger, agricultural, mm-hmm. and back out of the negatives and into some positives to balance off what we're doing in the negative, the military side. Mm-hmm. But that's assuming that you have a great deal of power.
Sort of going off on that again, I don't think in this country we have even begun to explore the other possibilities for security in our world. I think that we've sort of gone off on the track of military security and forgotten about, you know, all the other kinds of things that make for peace. And we've concentrated the best brains in our country on how to make more sophisticated weapons and that kind of thing. I don't think that we have really concentrated energy and intellectual abilities and common sense in a lot of ways on the things that bring people together, that make for reconciliation. We've become so very technical about the way we're going to do this that we haven't really looked at the multitude of possibilities that there would be. I'm not saying that I have an answer as to what it would be, but I don't think that we have put enough energy into finding those possibilities. I think there's a certain paralysis in that fear, mm-hmm. that it's a tried and true sort of method that we haven't used.
Yeah, I don't think, probably nobody in this room that doesn't want to be secure, you know, in some way. I mean, the call of the cross of Jesus is that's never our ultimate goal. But it's a question of how.
I was just going to respond, I'm going to affirm that. And I heard Paul Simon speak from Illinois, and he was saying the most pressing problem in the world is hunger. And when people are hungry, they start doing evil, whatever. And if 20, 30 years ago, and it's not too late now, he had started feeding the people, giving them food and whatever, you know, these countries wouldn't be turning against us, and that would generate love. To me, that's where it starts.
Or maybe even more than giving them food, allowing countries to develop their own agricultural resources. And they're both, I'm sure, virgin.
Okay, it seems to be the nature of man, because look what the Israelites did. They wanted the king. As soon as they got a king, they had armies and everything. And as they were marching, well, maybe not marching, but they're marching across the wilderness for 40 years in circles probably, military was their might. And then I was going to say in response to this, if you had a Christian in charge of everything, I think it would depend on that Christian's basic beliefs. Because I can name an awful lot of Christians who say, yes, that we must have strong might, for Proverbs says so. And it would depend on the orientation, I think, of the Christian.
I want to ask a question. It's always interesting to me how, you know, quickly a discussion moves to kind of what should the United States government do. And I'd like to ask, how do you feel about really what I said tonight, that we are under the control of demonic powers? I mean, it's what I said. That's my theological analysis of the, you know, go ahead. Do you agree?
I think that in a way relates to the question of what are we afraid of? Uh-huh. And something that, say Christ has made you free, and if you are free, you should no longer be enslaved, or do not become enslaved again to the powers of darkness. And I wonder what it is about our faith that does not allow us to be free of that fear. Uh-huh. And I know it's a reality in the world, but somewhat
seems
to me that our faith should enter into that fear. And that seems to be a demonic thing.
Yeah. The fact that our faith has a, you know, the book of Luke just says over and over again, fear not, fear not, fear not. The faith and the ridding of fear seem to just go hand in hand. Why don't they for us? I don't know.
I want to go back over your 3 points on that. And I can't remember them all exactly. The first one was something which you give your belief, the promise of you something.
Total allegiance. Yeah.
Okay, I think the total allegiance, that's the second point. The first was the promise, and the second was the allegiance to the promise.
Yeah, promise of security.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
I think the second point is one where I have the hardest time with. Mm. I mean, the promise is certainly there, I mean, many, many times.
Yeah.
This military buildup is a way of security. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that the allegiance is necessarily there to it at this point.
Yeah, and I think I want to make that clear, you know, that that's my perception. Mm-hmm. That not only the United States, but we live in a world where we have given so much of our resources to military power and let hunger, you know, starvation, poverty just go become worse and worse and worse as we kind of give totally, as I see it, as I perceive it, to that area that you, then you.
Isn't there not another force that's more so than the allegiance to the military? It's the allegiance. Why do we want to have a military? Mm-hmm. It's the economic system.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
We're there, and that's, you know, our allegiance is to that.
That's right.
Yeah. Because we came out of the Second World War, I think, thinking that it would solve our economic problems. Is that part of what you mean, or?
Yes, now the structure that we have, a great deal of the economy, the foundation of our economy, the production of arms are military related. Mm-hmm. I live in an area of the country where we're quite vitally affected. Our economy goes downhill if the military production goes down.
It's interesting, you can almost follow that with historic decisions after the Second World War.
Yeah.
Deciding that we'll maintain a military economy, and then from that having to build up a real fear of the Soviet Union in order to keep that system going. And the question is, did it go out of control? Has it gone out of control? And that's, you know, my perception is yes. You know, it's gone way beyond.
That there were demonic powers in the Soviet Union, atheistic Soviet Union, and that part of this idea that we have to defend our country is that we will not want to be taken over by an atheistic system that says that religion is the opiate of the people, and if we do not agree with them, it takes very good care to eliminate you. And I really think that this is part of what's back of a good many people, I think, feeling that you are resisting this demonic idea of a state.
Yeah, and see, then the question then that comes in my mind, you know, in our response to what we see in the Soviet Union, when you look at this chart, has it, you know, and I'm thinking about you and your children, grandchildren, and your loved ones and everybody, has it gone so out of control that
you think it's a field of theirs best sense. I think we doubt that a lot.
Yeah. Anybody?
Well, I kind of have a response to that, that a lot of Christians are concerned about the atheism of communist Russia. It seems to me, though, well, I've heard lots and lots of stories about a strong Christian, not even underground, the Christian church is tolerated there in a different sense than here. But there are Christians, millions, as I understand it, of Christians in Russia, even though it is not officially encouraged. Aside from that, it seems to me that the prophets in the Bible, at least, maybe there are other parts of the Bible that say otherwise, the prophets in the Bible are concerned about people losing faith in God, not in situations where they are oppressed and held back from their faith, say, as in Russia, but the prophets are concerned about people losing faith when they are strong and powerful and being unjust in their powerfulness, which is, I really believe is the situation in the United States right now. So if I actually had to choose which would be better for building of faith, it almost seems like the people in the Soviet Union that know how precious their faith is, how that's all they have is their faith in Christ, they may be better off in some ways than we are as we sit here powerful and comfortable and the oppressors.
We have so many choices of other gods to worship.
Yeah,
other
that's true.
To put our belief in.
In the meantime, our children and all the children of the United States who are hungry and poor and are not being given good example by a sustained love of people that call themselves Christians are going down the tube. And the stronger we make our nation by giving ourselves self-respect, and each and every child in this nation to be given respect, the stronger the threat we will be to any country that is supposedly non-Christian.
Yeah, I think it's a question. The scriptures say this over and over again, that a nation is most vulnerable when it's spiritually weak. And has very little. There's a hand back here, and then Linda, you had your hand.
A comment on the question about godless atheism in Russia. That's not something I'm personally very much afraid of. I'm not afraid that the Soviets will take us over with their godless atheism. I respect those who have that fear, because I think that comes. And I was pretty young in the era of Joe McCarthy and others. But my question would be, for that fear, is the answer to that fear the kind of nuclear buildup that we're doing? It's a matter of where do we place our confidence to address the fears that haunt us?
Do we resist evil with evil?
Yes.
I
think it's demonic then when our fears, which may be quite legitimate, get used and twisted. Well, Jesus talks about wolves that come in sheep's clothing. And I think somewhat that's what's happened. That's how the demonic comes to us. The demonic does not come as something that looks blatantly and apparently evil, but something that presents itself as good and wholesome. And that's a sign that it's truly demonic.
If they destroy us and we destroy them, what else have we got to
live? We'll continue this tomorrow at 7.